TSN 1290, CFRW Winnipeg. All sports, baby! All the time. A division of Bell Media.
If you want to know the real deal about the three, well, let me take it with Triple Chop. We're going to bring you up to speed.
TSN 1290 presents the Illegal Curve Hockey Show with Drew Mandel, Richard Pollock, and Ezra Ginsberg.
Manitoba, and for all those listening at tsn1290.ca, good morning, universe, and welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. I'm your host, Drew Mandel, joined in studio by my colleagues Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. Producer Tim gets us on and off the air like the expert that he is. 2 hours of hockey talk for you on this Saturday. Joining us in about 30 minutes' time, Minnesota Wild color analyst Mike Greenlay is going to join us. We'll talk about the Jets' new division rival in the Minnesota Wild and the offseason that they're having. Get some insight into new Jets acquisition, Devin Setoguchi. About an hour from now, Ken Danico from MSG Plus, he's the New Jersey Devils color analyst, is going to join us. Talk about Ilya Kovalchuk, talk about the Devils' offseason, and talk about the Hockey Hall of Fame induction announcements of Scott Niedermeyer and Brandon Shanahan. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. You can follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/Illegal Curve. And our website with the latest NHL and Winnipeg Jets news is www.illegalcurve.com. Richie, Ezzy, I want to start with this question on this for this program on this Saturday. Alex Burmistrov, as we found out earlier this week, has left the Winnipeg Jets. He signed a 2-year deal with Akbars Kazan of the KHL. Who is to blame for the 8th overall pick from the Atlanta Thrashers a few years ago? Who is to blame for the fact he's no longer going to be playing in the NHL?
Well, first off, good morning, boys. You know, this Alexander Burmistrov news that came out has been really polarizing, and a lot of people are upset. Jets fans are upset that Alexander Burmistrov is going to the Continental Hockey League, a.k.a. Bars Kazan, and we're essentially losing a guy who has been part of the youth movement coming over from Atlanta into Winnipeg. But I think Alexander Burmistrov, Richie, deserves a lot of... He has to take a lot of credit for his own struggles. And sure, maybe he shouldn't have started in the NHL as an 18-year-old in Atlanta, and he probably would have been better served maybe spending another year in the OHL or maybe spending 1 or 2 years in the AHL. But last year, Alexander Burmistrov, I thought, was one of the Jets' better defensive players in the first half of the season. And then when he ran into problems with Claude Noel, and he wanted Claude Noel wanted Burmistrov to play more of a defensive role, Alexander Burmistrov acted like a little kid, and he only is 21 years old, and his attitude changed completely. And I think Alexander Burmistrov didn't want to be here, and that's why I was telling anybody who would listen that I didn't think Alexander Burmistrov was coming back this year, because his head wasn't in it. And I think he has loads of talent, and I think he's young, and I think he can become an everyday NHL player if he wants to, Richie. But does he not have to take a lot of the responsibility for his own failings this year? Sure, maybe the organization rushed him in, but we have to remember, that was the Atlanta Thrashers organization that rushed him in.
Yeah.
It wasn't the Jets organization that rushed him in.
I think that's part of the blame goes to the fact that he was rushed in. And it's a big adjustment for a Russian youngster to come over to North America, get acclimated, learn the language, which he didn't really do well, if at all. Socialize and feel comfortable. Clearly, he's probably homesick. I think that was one of the reasons why. But at the same time, I mean, part of the development is he came over to play in the OHL before, so it wasn't as if, you know, North America, his trip to North America to play in the NHL was his first time over. Overall, I think the majority of the blame falls on Alexander Burmistrov's shoulders, because he wanted to get paid and he wanted to be something that he wasn't really capable of yet. He wanted to be the second line center for the team. He couldn't do that job. His game was moving away from the net, not towards the net. You know, the fight was over east, west, north, south. If you play a strong side-to-side game, east-west game, then the coach doesn't really care if you're really playing that well. The problem is when you're playing it poorly, like he was, the coach wants you to simplify your game. Is he defensively adept? Sure. Can he score? Not really. He can pass. Yeah, if he did, he made quicker decisions. But overall, you know, he didn't want to buy in to the team model. And when you play with guys like that as a winger, you're like, well, what do I care when I cross the blue line? He's going to curl around for half an hour and do nothing. So you become disinterested. I think overall, he blew it for himself. Now he's going to get more money, sure, in the KHL, in a league that's high quality, but certainly not as high quality as the National Hockey League. He's going to go over there, and maybe he does develop. Maybe he does mature. Maybe he never comes back. All in all, I mean, it's obviously a wasted asset for the Jets organization, but I'm not sure how much of the blame really needs to fall on the Jets' shoulders in this situation.
Well, shouldn't the blame fall on the Jets' shoulders in the sense that they've lost an asset?
Yeah.
They lost an eighth overall pick for absolutely nothing.
But
I mean, they
yeah.
lost the pick from the 2010 NHL draft for absolutely nothing.
That's also like that investment theory and all that, in that you stick with a guy for too long because you've put time and effort into him, as opposed to cutting ties when you should, even though he was a high pick.
So you're
even
saying,
even though you had high expectations for him. Sometimes, now he decided here to cut the cord more than they did, but although I think they probably both did. But the idea is that you need to distance yourself. And I think that's one of the benefits here, in that Shevodayov didn't draft him. And because when you draft a player, sometimes you're more tied to him and you wait longer and longer for him to develop. So here there wasn't that indebtedness.
I don't think that, well, we should you know, mention that Burmistrov's rights are held by the Jets till he's 27. So he signed a two-year deal with AK Bars Kazan. I think it's 27.
It's 27. Yeah.
27. So they have his rights. He can't play for another NHL team. So if he wants to come back 2 years from now, it'll be with the Jets. We should mention that. So they haven't lost him, per se. But I don't think the Jets are that unhappy that he's decided to play in the KHL. I mean, he was benched last year. He was a healthy scratch for four games. I don't think he's Claude Noel's favorite player. Mm-hmm. And I'm one of the biggest Burmistrov fans out there. If you remember, we did our midseason grades. I gave him an A, and I think that was the highest out of all of us. And people were saying, Burmistrov, A, he only had 5 or 6 points. He didn't have a good offensive year. I look at a guy like Burmistrov, I think it's his head. I think it's the mental side of the game. I think that he is not committed to doing what you have to do to keep a spot in the NHL. I mean, just because he's a first-round pick and, you know, he's got all of this talent, I think there is a sense of entitlement with him a little bit. I think he sees mm-hmm. that he was an eighth overall pick, and he's got all of this talent, and I think he almost carries himself on and off the ice like he's Alexander Ovechkin, that he's one of the best players in the NHL. And again, I like Burmistrov's game, but I think that he's not going to be a top six forward, and he's going to have to be a guy who is more of a defensive forward that chips in on the penalty kill, and he gets maybe 12 to 15 minutes a game. And I think that's how he's going to carve himself out a role in the NHL. In the KHL, it's a totally different story.
How many goals do you think he's had in his highest season?
Eight or ten.
He had 13 goals for the Jets in 11-12. He only scored 22 goals for Barrie in 62 games in 2009-2010. I mean, he hasn't proven to really score that highly at any level. His assist totals maybe aren't as high as you like them to be. I mean, I said it, what, the beginning of last year? Even before last year, maybe? I mean, I think he's going to be a third-line center, a defensively
right.
responsible third-line center that
right.
can create some offense and could carve out a niche for himself if he decided to play that role. Doesn't mean you don't strive to be better, but I think that was kind of what he was going to be. And do the Jets, will the Jets miss him? Well, you know, he's talent-wise, yeah, they'll miss him, but up the middle now, you know, you have Little, you have Jokinen, and Scheifele, you hope, takes that step, and then you have Slater, so... Is that the best center group in the league? Far from it.
We know that it's hard to be a young second line center. That's why there is a lot of concern, and they're being very careful with Mark Scheifele. And it's tough to be a second line center. It's also tough to be a third line center. I mean, each one of these roles has its responsibilities. I mean, if you want to be a guy that's first penalty killing unit, and you want to be depended on, you have to earn that trust from the coach. I think he had little trust from Claude Noel last year, and he ended up getting benched. Well, I don't think that Claude Noel was confident putting him out there in most situations.
Let me ask you guys this. When the writing was on the wall, and I suspect that at some point in time, the relationship between the organization and Claude Noel and Burmistrov got so poisonous, probably around when he was the healthy scratch, it got so poisonous that the organization probably recognized he wasn't going to be long for Winnipeg.
I think it wasn't during the healthy scratch. I think it was right after the healthy scratch.
Okay, when he didn't really change?
Yeah.
Okay, fine.
What about going back to St. John's? Remember St. John's? He wasn't playing well, and then he had the injury, and then he didn't want to go back. He showed that he didn't want to be in St. John's. And there were, remember, he threatened to go back to the KHL at that point, if you remember.
Well, if all that, you know, having occurred, should the organization have done everything in their power to try and get something for him at that point? Or do you think the organization
think
the organization was happy to sort of banish him to the KHL, saying, if you don't play under our rules, we're not going to give you an easy out. You can go play in Russia and nobody will hear from you again?
Maybe, but I think if they were going to trade him, they had to have traded him before all that became public, because they lost all their leverage.
Well, I mean, then shouldn't they have traded him? I mean, right now, let me ask you this question. Two-part question. One, do you think he ever plays for the Winnipeg Jets again?
No.
And two, do you think he ever plays in the NHL again?
I don't think he ever plays for the Jets again. I would say over the course of the next 15 years, he probably does play in the NHL again.
The Jets have never admitted this, but I tend to believe that they were shopping him at the trade deadline. They would never admit that.
Well,
I don't think they've ever came out and said that.
I think you're probably right, Ezzy, that they probably were shopping him. Then if they knew that the writing was on the wall, shouldn't they have maybe accepted 75 cents on the dollar rather than trying to get full value for a guy you don't think is going to be on your team the next year?
I don't know about that.
What's full value?
Well, whatever. I mean, you're right. I mean, full value is obviously dependent. I mean, they were in a position of weakness. Every team can read the headlines and see what's going on. This guy has fallen out of favor. He's got a bad attitude, or there's a bad relationship between him and the head coach. You know, so they're not going to offer full value for him, whatever that may be. Each team can think they can get him for a bargain basement price.
I'd be shocked if he was offered anything more than the third rounder.
So you don't buy the Drew Stafford for Alex Burmistrov chatter that we heard?
No.
I don't think teams were offering top six forwards for Burmistrov, right? Because they look at him and they say, is he a top six forward, or is he a guy that is more likely a project? I think for teams, they were looking at him like a project. It might work out. It might not work out.
Do you think this is a setback for the organization, or is this just a guy who wasn't ever going to do anything anyways?
I don't think it affects the organization too much. No. Because, you know, if Scheifele can come in, and this is a year for Scheifele to really make a move, and if he can come in and essentially replace him, then sure, you're good to have Burmistrov there, but I don't think it's a huge loss.
I don't think the Jets management group or the coaching staff liked his attitude and his work ethic, and in that respect, it's unfortunate, but Burmy kind of, you know, bought his own ticket out of town, unfortunately.
Well, last question. Does Alex Burmistrov play for Team Russia at the Sochi Olympics?
I mean, Team Russia is not as deep as they once were. So that gives me an idea that he may very well make that team as a fourth line kind of defensive guy.
Do you think there's a quid pro quo? You come back to Russia, play in the KHL, we'll give you a spot on the team?
Well, it is Russia.
That's what I'm saying. It wouldn't be the most surprising thing in the world. Anyways, let's go to break. When we come back, we're going to talk about a player who does want to be in Winnipeg. That's new Jets signee Matt Halaschuk. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. This segment is brought to you by the Certified General Accountants Association of Manitoba. The CGA Association of Manitoba is the largest, fastest growing, and most diverse accounting body in the province. Did you know that CGAs are among the top 5% of income earners in Canada, with an average yearly salary of $72,000 for new graduates? For more information, contact the CGA Association at cga-manitoba.org. The CGA Association of Manitoba, we see more than numbers. Gentlemen, the Jets made a free agent signing this week, getting Matt Halaschuk on a one-year, two-way deal. It pays him $650,000 for the Jets and $250,000 if he is sent down to the AHL St. John's Ice Caps. Your thoughts on Matt Halaschuk as a player, Richard Pollock?
Well, I'll be honest, Drew. I didn't know a damn thing about Matt Halaschuk when they signed him. I've seen him sparingly in terms of playing for the Devils and then for the Predators, but not really watching him that intently. So I figured this morning I'd kind of watch some tape of Matt Halaschuk to get an idea of his game. And from what I saw, I like what I saw for the most part. I mean, if you're looking at a fourth line right winger, the one thing that I liked about his game is that he goes to the net. Like, his default is to go to the net. No matter what, when the puck, somebody has the puck on the periphery or even the middle, he goes to the net. And I think last year the Jets had a lot of time. Well, first of all, they didn't have any sustained pressure for the most part. They're not a really good cycle team. You know, they're scoring off the rush. But sometimes they had a lack of traffic in front and some rebound and dirty goals. I think Matt Halaschuk's going to be a nice addition and going to be able to allow some of the skill players to throw the puck on net and Matt Halaschuk can clean it up. Is it going to be a huge difference maker? No. But is he an upgrade on the right side again? Is he an upgrade on Peluso and Thorburn? With all due respect to those two players, I think he is. And so your right side now is going to be Wheeler, Frolik, probably your three, Setoguchi, your two, and then your four will probably be Halaschuk. So overall, their right side couldn't have been any worse last year, and so signing anybody would have made them better. But I think they have improved their right side quite a bit.
Is he a bona fide NHL player, is he?
He is a bona fide NHLer. We should mention that with Nashville last year, he played 36 games. He only had 11 points. He's actually sent down to the AHL last year, and his contract with the Jets, I believe, is two-way.
Yes, it is.
So he was sent down to Milwaukee for a brief conditioning stint, and then he came back up, and he played better in the second half of the season, had 10 points in the last 20 games, and then got injured. I watched Halaschuk a little bit more. If you remember, he got the game-winning goal for the junior team. And was it 2008?
2008, yeah, overtime.
Yep, and he's a Devils prospect, so, you know, me being a guy who follows the Devils closely than most. But he is a bona fide NHLer, and Richie touched on it. Halaschuk is the type of guy, he's a sandpaper guy. You're going to put him on the third or fourth line. Most likely the fourth line, but, I mean, he's a third or fourth line guy, and he's going to chip in the odd goal. He's not going to score 20 goals, but he has the potential to pop in 10 goals. And he's going to be a guy that's going to add grit to this team. And I like the moves that Chevy has made. I really do. And I like Setoguchi, Frolik, and Halaschuk as an upgrade over Mietinen, Wellwood, Antropov. I mean, I'll take those three guys.
Yeah, I'd take like three strangers off the street more than those guys.
No, but you know what I mean? Like, I mean, he's added Frolik just coming off the cup win. He's going to add to the penalty kill, great speed. We've talked about how fast he is. Setoguchi's a fast guy with a good shot. You know, the debate is open until whether he will get 20, 25 goals playing with the Scheifele or Jokinen, because he has played with Joe Thornton, as Richie alluded to. He's played with Mikko Koivu, as Richie alluded to last week. But a guy like Halaschuk, I want a guy who wasn't re-signed and he's hungry. I think Halaschuk is a guy who's going to be hungry for a roster spot. And, you know, when he was interviewed, he said he was excited to come to Winnipeg. Nashville decided not to retain him. And I like the move. We need players.
Does he make the Jets harder to play against?
He's not the most aggressive guy, Drew. You know, I mean, that doesn't mean he's not willing to go to dirty areas, but he's not going to be flying around hitting everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Not the best skater. He's got kind of a sneaky good wrist shot, though. And overall, I mean, you know, he's played in two systems in New Jersey and Nashville that are very aware defensively. And by what I can tell, he seems to, you know his defensive responsibilities. He's just an upgrade skill-wise over what they had. And that's what I think at the end of the day, what it is.
And he's not going to cheat you effort-wise?
No.
He's blue-collar.
Yeah,
that's
right. Yeah.
Okay. Moving, you wanted to spend some time talking about the David Perron deal to Edmonton,
yeah,
as it pertains to the Devin Setoguchi deal to Winnipeg.
Well, first I wanted to talk about the Perron deal quickly. I thought,
For those who don't know, David Perron traded from St. Louis to the Edmonton Oilers in exchange for Magnus Piarvi,
yeah,
and a second-round draft pick.
Kind of odd. And obviously, salary cap reasons, St. Louis is probably getting rid of him.
Right.
I think stylistic reasons, too, in terms of how he plays a different style than Ken Hitchcock is in favor of. That is the whole east-west, north-south idea. Edmonton doesn't really need skill up front and certainly doesn't need small skill up front, but I still think it's a pretty good deal for them. I think that one of the differences, and now I want to kind of say, okay, so the Jets trade for Setoguchi. They trade a second-round pick for Setoguchi. Edmonton trades a second-round pick for Perron, and they added Magnus Piarvi, who's a You know, I think a bona fide NHL player. I don't think he has the hands to be a scorer. I don't think he's a top six guy. I think he's a third, fourth line guy. Probably a third line winger. Good speed. A top end skater. He'll be able to pressure in Ken Hitchcock's system. And he does all those things. But the question to me is, why does Edmonton give up Pyarvi when the Jets don't give up anything aside from a second rounder?
Sure.
I think the thought process is that Perron is a more talented player than Setoguchi. I think he's played in a more restrictive system as opposed to, you know, in St. Louis as opposed to Setoguchi in Minnesota, but more so in San Jose. They're very close in age. Well, I looked at the stats, and I thought it was interesting. Setoguchi's 26, Perron's 25, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Setoguchi and Perron, Setoguchi's played 384 NHL games. Perron's played 340. Now, Perron had those concussion issues by Joe Thornton, who played with Setoguchi. They both score points in 58% of their games. They have identical point-per-game averages, which is interesting, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Setoguchi scores a little more. Perron gets more assists. So it's interesting to see that Pyarvi is added into that deal, even though their production is almost identical. Now, the way they get to the production is different, and that's the key. And I think the other key is that Perron is signed for a four-year deal.
Well, that's what I was going to say. How much of the Pyarvi has to do with the fact that Perron is under contract for three more years whereas Setoguchi is a UFA after this year.
I look at that move, guys, as almost that trade could have almost have been a straight-up trade, and you're paying for Perron's grit by adding in the second rounder, or you're throwing in Pyarvi for the grit. Like, I think that the Edmonton Oilers need a guy like Perron, and they don't need they're chocked full of speedy, skilled guys up the middle and on the wings. Like, you know, we could go over the list: Yakupov, Eberle, Nugent Hopkins, Hall, Pyarvi. Kind of like, you know, what's the plan for Pyarvi? Well, he's struggled.
Yeah.
He hasn't done a lot in his first few years in the NHL. They need a guy like Perron to put on, you know, put him up there, and he's going to crash and bang. I really like Perron, but he has struggled since his concussion. He missed basically a full season. But Perron is in the corners, loves to have the puck and cycle it. You remember when he was in Winnipeg last, we were making comments about, like, Oshie and Perron. These guys, they get the puck in the corner, and they're tough to... He's mm-hmm. a really tough guy to get off the puck. Perron's not the type of guy that's going to stick handle through the entire team, but he's kind of a guy who dump the puck in the corner, go get it, and use his strength. He's not the biggest guy, but he's a very tough guy to get off the puck, like I just mentioned. But I think, you know, they might have paid a little bit too much when you consider that they got Setoguchi. They probably like the fact, too, that I believe Perron's under contract for two more years.
Well,
two or three more years.
Perron's got really good hands, and you know, he'll try and make moves and try and create. So he's going to be able to play with Edmonton talent. I think that's going to be a key. But I just thought it was interesting to see, you know, kind of that's the market at play, right? You know, that's the value. I think Perron, in the perspective of talent evaluators, is a more talented. He is more naturally talented than Setoguchi. I don't think there's a question about that.
How much of an injury risk do you factor that into the trade? I mean, Perron, you know, did miss a fair bit of time with concussion problems.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think he did. This past year, he played every game, though. So
you think it's overrated?
And the two seasons before that, he played every game except for one. So,
well, then let me ask you this. Who would you rather have? I mean, you know, would you rather have Setoguchi or would you rather have Perron?
I'd rather have Perron.
So should the Jets have thrown in...
Well, you don't know what they... That's what I was kind of getting at. You know, what would it have cost the Jets to add in a package to get Perron? And then the question also is, Setoguchi, Frolik, and Hallestrick are all in-division players. Now, Hallestrick wasn't qualified, so they didn't keep him. But the other two players, Setoguchi and Frolik, those teams weren't worried about putting them in the division. You have to wonder if Perron, from St. Louis's perspective, was somebody they wanted out of the division.
Because you think he's more talented than Setoguchi?
Yes, I do.
We were talking about Perron at the draft. We were talking about Perron at the draft, and he was one of those guys that St. Louis was shopping, and we were wondering if the Jets would maybe make a move to get a guy like Perron. I like Setoguchi. I mean, if you're comparing straight up, I mean, maybe Perron gets the edge. You know, he's scored a little bit more, and he's got maybe a little bit more of an upside, and he's a little bit tougher. But I like the trade for Edmonton. I really like all the moves they've made. They've got Ferentz. I really like him. Clark MacArthur. Or he went to Ottawa, sorry. But I like, you know, bringing in Ferentz and Perron. They have to get stronger, tougher. They need to insulate those younger guys.
Well, I think they still need to do that.
You're talking about the Oilers right now.
Yeah, but Perron gives them a talent level, another addition to their talent base which is, I mean, ridiculous. You think Hall and Eberle and Perron. And although Eberle, Perron, and Gagne are all small right-handed shooting guys.
Yep.
I think there's something to be said for Perron having cost certainty, because the Oilers, if you look at their roster, with everybody set to be a UFA or an RFA coming up very quickly, you don't know how you're going to be able to fit all those guys under the cap. With Perron, you know what it's going to cost you for the next 3 years.
Right. And I mean, I just think that what McTavish, this is McTavish's perspective as far as I'm concerned. I can add talent. Perron is more talented than PRV. And I got a ton of young talent here, and I got some young defensemen in the system. The second-round pick isn't as valuable to me as it was 4 years ago.
Let's go to break. When we come back, Mike Greenlay, the Minnesota Wild color analyst, is going to join us. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. All right. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and the website is www.illegalcurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show hotline.
We welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. He's the Minnesota Wild color analyst, Mike Greenlay. Mike, good morning. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. How are you guys doing?
We're doing very well. How about yourself, Mike?
Oh, hanging in there.
That's good. That's good. That's always good. Mike, we got to start with Devin Setoguchi. As you obviously know, the Wild made the trade about a week, 10 days ago now, where they sent him to the Winnipeg Jets in exchange for a second-round pick. As a guy who has watched Devin Setoguchi for the last number of years, what does he bring to the table as an NHL player?
Well, I think he's initially you see a top six guy that can score goals. That's what his role is. But last year, we actually added some new elements to his game. He actually added a physical side to it that we hadn't really seen in the previous years, and I think he did that mostly to try and diversify his game a little bit. He's been historically, I don't want to call him streaky. I think that's kind of a derogatory term for a player that's a scorer. But even saying that, he does score in bunches when he does. Sometimes you hit some dry spells, and then when you are hitting one of those dry spells, you need to add something to your game. You need to bring something else to the table. And last year, he added a physical element to his game that I thought was great. I mean, I think it really makes him a better player. It allows him to contribute in other ways when the puck's not going in the net for him. So, you're getting a pretty decent player there.
Mike, why did the Wild make this trade?
You know, honestly, I think there's a couple reasons why. I think they're a team that's growing, but they want to start growing through their youth a little bit. That's part of it. The other part of it, I think, is a cap issue. They want to clear up some space, and they likely feel that that a player that could be moving up and young and make less money that could likely bring maybe some goal scoring to a close level that Devin Setoguchi would. That would be a decent trade off for them in order not to have to pay the contract that Setoguchi has. So I think there's various elements. I don't think there's a one or two points that you could make. But I think those are some of the key ones. Like I say, it's a cap issue, it's a dollar issue. The Wild are very close; they need some wiggle room. And the other thing is the development and ice time that they need to start giving to some of their younger guys if they're going to turn into players that can play consistently in the top six.
Mike, a couple of weeks ago at the draft in Newark, the Wild traded Cal Clutterbuck for Nino Niederreiter, a guy who a couple of years ago played for the Islanders and then last year wasn't playing in the NHL. I know Cal Clutterbuck was a very popular player in Minnesota. What were your thoughts on that trade, and what do you think the plan is for Nino Niederreiter next year for Minnesota?
Well, I think the thought is maybe that Niederreiter didn't get the proper guidance or the proper opportunity. And certainly not putting that all on the Islanders' shoulders. Niederreiter has to contribute as well, but when it comes to young players, there needs to be almost a management of expectations. There needs to be a management of where you think that player can fit in, and you have to sometimes you have to carry him along a little bit. And, sometimes you have to put him in the minors a little bit. It's hard to say till we get to see him on a full-time basis. But he certainly was highly touted when he was drafted, and he certainly seems like a kid who's got an upside from the offensive standpoint. And, you know, when it comes to young players like that, I think a lot of general managers feel that if they can get players like that, even if they haven't worked out in other organizations, that they can take them, manage them, move them along, and encourage them and get them to the point where their initial expectation was. So I think there's some upside there, and I think the Wild feel that they can bring this guy in and have him be a top player for them eventually, if not immediately. As far as Cal Clutch is concerned, you know, I think Cal, he's going to do very well with the Islanders. I think maybe got a little stale here just because, you know, it's not easy to play the game that he plays. I'll tell you, it's like, you know, it's not easy to be a fighter. It's not easy to be a guy that hits, you know, everything that moves out there. It takes a toll. And I think that he needs maybe, a new landscape to show off that part of his game. He got to a point, I think, with the Wild where, you know, he was hitting not as frequently, and when he was, he was taking himself out of position to do so, and he wasn't putting the puck in the net with the opportunities he had. So, you know, maybe a good thing for both sides. Kyle Clutterbuck gets kind of a new venue in which to bring some excitement, and he also, we also get a decent player in return.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're joined by Mike Greenlay, color analyst for the Minnesota Wild. Mike, the Wild dipped into free agency, and they acquired Matt Cook, ex of the Pittsburgh Penguins, on a 3-year deal. Do you think his history will be an issue in the Wild dressing room?
I don't think so. I don't think there's any players around from the time that he was, doing his thing there, with the Canucks against the Wild. I mean, maybe you have a conversation with Darby Hendrickson, who's now an assistant coach, who was playing back then. But like I say, Mikko Koivu, I think, was around then. But, players, it's funny. I mean, we've seen players move from team to team that have previously had issues that then become teammates. Hockey's a funny world like that. And I think that the truth is that Matt Cook has maybe taken the element of his game away that is getting him into trouble. And I guess the hope would be that he doesn't take too much of that game away, because that is the type of style that the Wild are trying to acquire. They are, at least in a small part, trying to pick up a player that has an edginess to him, that can stir things up when you need him to. You can't always just throw out your top line and expect him to score. Sometimes you got to throw out some guy like that and have him stir up the other team and maybe throw them off their game a little bit before you're able to, take advantage of the other team. But I personally think it's a good signing. How he is in the locker room and the reception he gets from a lot of fans here will like be the story to tell. But initially, a lot of people were up in arms about it. I think that a player like that, though, typically ingratiates himself with the fans because of the way he plays. And as long as he's, like I said, as long as he's not taking himself out of the game or out of the lineup because of things that were extracurricular in nature, I think fans will love it. Will love him just because he's going to be doing what he's doing for them rather than against them.
Mike, the Wild re-signed goaltender Nicklas Backstrom for a 3-year deal, $3.4 million cap hit per season. Was that just a logical fit for both sides at the end of the day?
I really believe it. Yeah, it had to happen. I mean, you had mutual desire there. I mean, I don't think Nicklas Backstrom wanted to go and restart with another organization. He's not that type of guy. I think there's a lot of guys that when they get into a comfort level, they're not good. But I think Nicklas Backstrom gets into a comfort level, he is good. And barring any health issues or injuries, I think that he brings a steady edge to the Minnesota Wild goaltending. There wasn't a lot of other options out there. I mean, if you don't sign Nicklas Backstrom, then there wasn't really a lot on the free agent market there goaltending-wise, at least not in the price range that the Wild were looking for. And if they
did not get Nicklas Backstrom, all of a sudden you're, you know, getting into the trade market where you're, you know, picking off a guy from another team, but you're giving up prospects or drafts to get him, and it becomes very expensive. So I think from the big picture here, in terms of what could you get at this time, it was a great choice. It's someone you know, it's someone you're comfortable with, it's someone you know that can do the job for you. And for Nicklas Backstrom, for him as well, I mean, he knows where his career is at this point. He knows he's kind of on the, you know, on the tail end of it. And to pick off 3 years like this and get some a little bit more money, but also, you know, stay in a comfort zone with the Wild, I think it worked out for both sides very well. But I truly believe that this had to happen, because if it didn't, the Wild really would have had to scramble to try and find something that would work for them.
Mike, we have to ask you about Keith Ballard. And, you know, he had a rough year in Vancouver this past year as far as his offensive totals go, and he kind of, you could say, he was falling out of favor there in Vancouver. And is this almost the perfect opportunity for him to resuscitate his career in Minnesota?
You know what? I really believe so, because maybe less than what the Vancouver Canucks would expect, or their fans, or their media. I don't know if the Wild are actually expecting him to come in here and be an offensive juggernaut. I mean, I think the Wild are looking for him to come in and add a puck moving element, add a guy who can shoot, and a guy who can maybe help them from a power play perspective here and there, and even 5-on-5. But I don't think I think Vancouver had different expectations for what he could provide, and maybe this is a good opportunity for him to come in and work on his game in that regard, but not have it have to be the sole part of his game. He gives the Wild another element on defense that they definitely need. I mean, signing Spurgeon again is great. Obviously, they have Suter and Brodin up there as a top pairing. So I think this does fill in some gaps here for the Minnesota Wild, and hopefully hopefully he's able to take this opportunity, because he's probably going to get some decent ice time back there, and we'll see how he does with it. Hopefully he doesn't have to come in and feel like the game revolves around his offensive efforts.
Mike, we'll let you go on this last question. It's a two-parter. Part one, is this the roster that the Wild will take to training camp? Part two, if so, are they a better team this year than they are than they were last year?
That's a really good question. I think this is. I can't imagine too many more moves. At least ones that are maybe, I guess, what you'd call noteworthy. They might pick off a few more elements here to push them from the underside and push upwards. But I think this is pretty much what you're looking at. And are they going to be better than last year? I think just in the fact that they have a little bit more of the defined elements. Pominville will be in the fray, and he'll be able to, instead of the Wild trying to figure out where to piece in guys like Pierre-Marc Bouchard and Pominville in second and third lines and so on and so forth, I think Pominville can become a bona fide top six guy like he should be. I think also the fact that the young guys that came in last year and that were, definitely untested, guys like Zucker, guys like Coyle, maybe even Granlund, just a lot of the young, talented guys that the Wild have, they have that extra year under their belt. They have that experience. Now their expectations are different for themselves and the team, and so I think they'll come in and they'll be better just by the fact that they've been through the mill a little bit here in the National Hockey League. Hard to say whether the Wild are better. I think they will be, just by the virtue of the fact that they are a team that is maybe gotten to know each other a little bit better now. Like Parisi and Suter know their roles, and I think they mesh pretty well with the team now. So I think in that light, the Wild should be a better team.
Mike Greenlay, Minnesota Wild color analyst, thanks very much for joining us this morning on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. And we'll be seeing a lot of you in Winnipeg over the next number of years.
Yeah, I look forward to it, guys. Take care.
Take care, Mike. Thanks very much. Let's go to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. 10
7 minutes before the top of the hour. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Big thank you to Mike Greenlay for having just joined us. This segment of the program is brought to you by our friends at Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club. Currently closed for renovations for this month, but they'll be back open very shortly at the beginning of August, and a great lineup in store for you. And of course, they are actually still putting on a show this coming Tuesday night for SiriusXM's Canada's Next Top Comic. So check out their website, rumorscomedyclub.com, for all the information and all the comedians that are upcoming in August. And of course, you can always find out how to purchase tickets there and for performances and showtimes, rumorscomedyclub.com. Gentlemen, the big news in the hockey world.
Before we start that.
Okay.
Ezra and I, my mom went out for dinner last night, and Ezra informed us that he has a shower issue. And I'd like him to tell the listeners about the shower issue before we get into the Ilya Kovalchuk talk.
It's funny. I guess this is the second week in a row that people are being informed about my domestic issues. Last week it was the snoring. I knew Rich was going to bring this up. I told him not to bring this up. It's not a big deal, but basically my shower, I have like one of those detachable showers, you know, that you move around, you know.
Yeah, just, okay.
You know, not, it's the shower
detachable
head.
Shower head.
Detachable yeah. Shower head. So the shower head was disconnected from the hose. I don't know, because it kept dropping on, you know, it hitting the floor of the bathtub or whatever. And so I haven't had time to go to Home Depot or whatever and get a shower head. So for the last 2 or 3 weeks, I've just been using basically a hose. Basically, I've been showering with a hose.
Like a farm animal. And before New York. 3 weeks ago.
Well, I mean, I work. I have commitments at night. I haven't had time to go and get a new shower head. Basically, all that needs to be done, I get a new shower head, or it needs
picture
to be reconnected.
Picture hosing himself off in the morning.
I mean, it's water. It's essentially doing the same thing. I mean, it's working out. It's not the most convenient. I definitely need to go get a shower head, but. Anyways, Richie thought it was... I told Richie last night, he was laughing for 20 minutes. He thought it was the funniest thing ever.
He's right. I mean, Richard had warned me that he was going to bring this up on air. He didn't tell me what it was. He just said, I have an Ezzy story to bring up on air. And I was admittedly a little nervous. I didn't know where the story was going. But that was well worth it.
That was,
the
no?
fact that you are, yeah, like a farm animal. You know, like being hosed off.
Let's go.
Yeah. Like you're just sitting there with a hose, like with water coming out of a hose. It's
speaking of getting hosed. Why don't we talk about the Devils?
Yeah, the Devils definitely got hosed.
to put it lightly.
Yeah, Ilya Kovalchuk, $77 million. I don't want it. I'm going back to Russia. Do you blame Kovalchuk?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, if you're not really sure about your long-term desires in the National Hockey League, then don't sign a 35-year deal. Don't sign a 10-year deal. That's my issue with it. If you're not sure, then you sign a shorter-term deal, and then you evaluate that time. But you signed that long-term deal, and then you bailed out, and you left the team. I mean, he almost has 500 goals, guys. The guy scores 30, 40 a year, like, in the sleep. Like, he comes to Winnipeg, and you're just like, wow, that guy just scores goals. And he's left this team that just lost Parise. Just lost Parise and Kovalchuk for nothing. And it's a gift that keeps on giving, because next year they're going to have to give up the first-round pick. They might be terrible now, even worse than they were going to be anyways, because he's bailed on them, and they lose that first-round pick because of the contract and the penalty handed down by Gary Bettman. I mean, Ilya Kovalchuk, I realize they came within two games of winning the Stanley Cup with him on the roster, and certainly his skill level is unquestionable. But as a whole, his tenure in New Jersey has been a complete disaster.
The only thing that was good that came out of this, I have a lot to say about this. We could spend the rest of the show talking about this if we needed to.
Much like we could with your shower habits.
Right. I'm surprised that Lou Lamoriello didn't go completely nuts, because he was asked, you know, are there any positives to take away from the last 3 years of Ilya Kovalchuk? And his answer was pretty blunt, and he said, I'll let you answer that. That was a direct quote. And he could have really said he was saying, absolutely not. Ilya Kovalchuk has left the Devils in an awful position. And I don't care if Ilya Kovalchuk wants to play in his home country and he wants to play the next 10 years in Russia. He signed a 15-year contract to play in the NHL in New Jersey in North America. He signed a contract. He put his name on a contract to play in the NHL in New Jersey. I repeat, in the NHL in New Jersey in North America. 15-year deal. The Devils are going to lose a first-round pick, which they had to give up for the salary cap circumvention in between 2011 and 2014, and they've waited because they obviously traded the pick for Corey Schneider, but they're going to give up their first-round pick in 2014. They gave up all of those guys, Johnny Oduya, Nicholas Bergfors, Patrice Cormier, I believe a first-round pick.
Yep.
They gave up all those guys to get Kovalchuk, and Kovalchuk decides, I'm going to retire from the NHL, and I'm going to go play in Russia because I'm from Russia, and, oh, sure, there's 12 years left on the deal. And it's unbelievable because it was broken down how much he was going to make, and Ilya Kovalchuk was going to make $10 to $11 million.
But hold on. Let's talk about the money for a second here.
Let's talk about the money. The Devils are
going to make more money in Russia. Don't tell me it's not about the money.
Yeah.
I don't want to hear it.
He probably will make $10 million in Russia.
The Devils
did say maybe $15 million he'll make, and the taxes are less there.
Yeah, taxes are only about 16%, whereas, you know, if you...
Jersey, it's 45.
35, 40%. I got to say, the Devils, I mean, Lou Lamoriello, who could have come out spitting mad.
He's classy.
I know he's classy, but they also could have blocked this by tolling his contract.
Yeah,
then
you have this moping goal scorer for the next 10 years, and everybody in the room this guy doesn't want to...
He could have just retired without being able to play in Russia. If they pull his contract, if they don't agree to terminate his contract, you know, it would end up in court.
No, but then he ends up playing, Drew, because he still wants the money, and then he ends up being a negative force in the room. That's the actual result. He wouldn't just not play.
I got to say, from an outsider's perspective, the Devils didn't seem that upset about not having to pay this contract, and I think the team's financial difficulties factor into that.
I'm not saying that you don't have something to it, but I don't agree for this reason. Ilya Kovalchuk, skill-wise, is top 10 in the NHL. Even at 30 years old, he's still a franchise player, and that's why they signed him to 15 years. His skill set, when he is on, he's a 40-goal, 80-point, 90-point guy, and you do not replace those guys easily. We've talked about that before on this show. Yep. You just don't replace those guys easily. And for that, in that respect, they've lost Zach Parise last summer.
Nothing.
They lost David Clarkson for nothing this past summer. Now they essentially lose Kovalchuk, not only for nothing, but they're going to lose the first-round pick next summer, and they lost all of those prospects. You don't think they'd want to have Patrice Cormier or Johnny Oduya still kicking around?
Maybe not.
This stinks so bad, and I know Lou Lamoriello was saying, oh, well, we talked about this, we tried to convince him. Remember when Ilya Kovalchuk, during the lockout, was playing for SKA St. Petersburg in the KHL, and he was saying, I'm going to stay here? And nobody really bought his bluff that he was going to stay there because he had a contract. I'm pretty sure that he has really rope-a-doped the New Jersey Devils. I think he said, okay, lockout's over, I'm going to come back now. And then he's decided to say... Maybe rope-a-dope was a wrong word based on the showerhead story.
I was thinking
story.
The same thing.
But, you know, I really think that's what the situation is. I mean, he came back and said, okay, I'm back now.
Isn't you showering a hose-a-dope?
Yeah, exactly. Ilya Kovalchuk has left them in a position now where how are you going to replace that offense? And now free agency, they've watched all of these guys sign with other teams. They've watched Parise go to Minnesota. Mm-hmm. Kovalchuk, they had Kovalchuk penciled in for the next 10 years in that lineup. Well, you know, 13 years or 12 years, however many years were left on his contract. But he, like, how do you take his word at all now? And
it's true.
The way I look at it, the way I look at this is he has really screwed the New Jersey Devils.
Yep.
And I know that the New Jersey Devils have some financial problems, but they are in such a bad position right now because they were a kind of a borderline playoff team next year in the East, Drew. So I like the Corey Schneider move.
Terrible, yeah.
I like the Corey Schneider move, but Ilya Kovalchuk's not there. Who's scoring goals for your team next year? Aside from, you know, Zajac and Henrik and Eliash. I mean,
they signed Ryder and they signed Klo.
Well, yeah.
Right.
I mean, you got to hope that, and they're hoping and counting and praying that those guys are bounced back for them. You know, I'll tell you what. Let's go to break. When we come back, Ken Danico from Madison Square Garden Network is going to join us to talk about the Devils and the Kovalchuk move and everything to do with that team. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're on TSN 1290, TSN1290.ca.
1 hour down, 1 hour to go. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and the website with your latest NHL and Winnipeg Jets news is www.illegalcurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show hotline.
We welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. He covers the New Jersey Devils for MSG Network, Ken Danico. Ken, good morning. Thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure. How are you?
Doing very well. How about yourself?
I'm doing good. Thank you.
That's good. Ken, it's, you know, 2 weeks ago, the entire hockey world was in New Jersey for the draft, and the focus was on the Corey Schneider trade that the Devils pulled off. And then, you know, late Thursday or in the sort of late afternoon on Thursday, the shocking news that Ilya Kovalchuk is going to retire from the NHL. How shocked were you about the Kovalchuk decision?
Well, I guess obviously very surprised, like a lot of people. I mean, shocked, yeah, it's probably the right term. However, if you take a step back and look at it, you're not going to replace Ilya Kovalchuk. We know he's a productive guy and a great offensive player. But in the long run, you got to look at it. I agree with a lot of people, the fact that it may be a blessing in disguise from the standpoint of the contract, because I don't think he was going to be able to fulfill it until he was 42, and that's how long it was going to be. And if you look at it, I mean, if he retired at 35, the cap hit would have been much worse for the New Jersey Devils, and we talked about the financial restraints along the way. Now I think, obviously, they're going to try to fill some voids, but, you know, you got to move forward. And if his heart wasn't 100% here in New Jersey, I don't care who you are or how good you are, it's going to be tough for him to play at his best. And the Devils just have to move forward after the shock, obviously, like you talked about. But I still think the Devils are going to be okay. I mean, they're just going to have to fill some voids. They added some guys in Ryan Cole and Mike Ryder, and they hope these guys can produce for them. And then a couple of guys that had off seasons, and it was a half year, so I give a lot of mulligans to a lot of players around the league. It was a little different situation for everybody coming into last season. And, you know, guys like Travis Sajak, Adam Henrik, who didn't produce offensively the way they're capable of, I expect them to bounce back and have good years, and they're going to try to fill the offensive void that way. And I'm sure Lou Lamoriello, general manager, will add another player here along the way with the cap space that was created with the Kovalchuk departure. And all you can do is move forward. I like Ilya Kovalchuk. I thought he was a heck of a player, and I thought he played real hard here in New Jersey. It took him a while to adjust. But at the end of the day, if his heart's not here, and obviously that it had a big impact when he played over in Russia. He's very close to a lot of Russian power brokers over there, and he's going to get paid a lot of money. I don't think it was a financial situation type move. He decided to go back, and I think that's how we have to look at it right now. There might be more down the road on what the actual reality of the situation was, but, you know, you got to move forward, and the Devils plan on doing that.
One more question here, Ken, on the Kovalchuk matter before we move to other, you know, other goings-on in New Jersey. You talked about it from the ownership and general manager perspective, and it very well in the long term may be beneficial business-wise, cap-wise, that Kovalchuk made the decision now as opposed to later. But from a player's perspective, you know, players think a little bit more short-term. You know, they obviously want to win the cup every year. If you're Travis Zajac, for example, or any other players in that room, would you feel betrayed by this decision?
You know, that's a tough question to answer. I mean, players, you know, have thick skin. Obviously, they were all shocked, I'm sure, and Marty Brodeur had mentioned it. So he was very surprised. Marty was close to him, and they didn't expect this, but obviously he'd been thinking about this, like he mentioned, and I believe that. I mean, he'd been thinking about doing this possibly along the way. I'm sure he was influenced by some guys in Russia that I had mentioned that said, you know, come over here and be a star in our league, and we're going to pay you a lot of money. The money is like water over there to certain corporations. They have sponsorships, and we know about the oil business and everything else. So the money is there. But I think short-term, yeah, it's going to hurt the Devils, no question. I mean, you can't avoid that. I mean, his production and everything else. But again, I just go back. I think the players are going to think the same way from the standpoint if his heart's not 100% in it. You're going to have to move forward. Betrayed might be a strong word. I mean, this is a person's life, his decision, and that's the way you look at it. Yeah, there's a lot of upset people, no question about it. But we will see how the season goes, how they start, and if they're able to move forward and get this off their plate and out of their minds as far as losing a real good hockey player, that's for sure.
Ken, how much more significant is the acquisition of Corey Schneider now that the Devils have lost Ilya Kovalchuk, or was Lou Lamoriello looking for the heir apparent to Marty Brodeur already, and that was something that he addressed at the draft?
Yeah, that was probably as big a shock as the Kovalchuk decision to go back to Russia. I mean, obviously, Corey Schneider, I think, became available, and I was with Marty Brodeur at the time when the trade was made, and he was a little bit stunned, no question about it, and taken aback a little bit. But it was inevitable. You're going to have to find the replacement. I don't think they felt they had a goalie in the minor leagues that was ready to step right in and be a National Hockey League goaltender. And we know the importance of goaltending, the most important position. So you want to solidify that. And in a weird way, I think you could push Marty Brodeur. Not that he needs any pushing. Regardless who you are, though, I believe if you're, you know, the stature of a Marty Brodeur, there's nothing wrong with having a little extra motivation, and now they're pretty set in goal. I think he's going to be wanting to push Corey Crawford. He's going to want to get his ice time, and he's at that stage of his career where certainly now he's going to be pushed. He did mention to me after the shock of the trade that he thinks Corey Schneider is one of the top five goaltenders in the National Hockey League. So he took the high road and said all the right things, but I believe Marty Brodeur is looking at it that way. He cares about the Devils organization, and he knows that he can't play forever. Unfortunately, they've had that position solidified for 20-plus years now, and not many teams can say that. So at the time, Schneider became available, and I think it was only a couple days before the draft that they could move Luongo. I think it was a good decision by the Devils, and but certainly a big surprise to everyone, and we know Lou's very capable of giving us surprises because he keeps things close to the vest and doesn't let you know what's going on too often. But he was able to pull the trigger, and we will see how it works out. But Corey Schneider certainly is one of the elite guys, and they should be good in goal for a few years to come now.
Ken, do you think this changes Marty's plans at all? I mean, we've heard that this might be his last year, but does acquiring Schneider change this at all? I mean, do you think it's possible that he decides maybe I'll play, you know, another 2 or 3 years maybe?
I think it all depends how his game is. I mean, regardless of Schneider coming in, if he's playing at a pretty good level and feels he can help, even if it starts to become a backup role, I mean, obviously, what better guy to mentor a young Corey Schneider and mentor not just goaltending, but certainly other guys in the locker room. He's a leader. His presence alone is so important with the New Jersey Devils. That's a possibility. I mean, he loves to play the game, and if you feel that you can continue to play, I think that might influence Marty Brodeur. But it all depends on his game. And you know, he's a prideful guy, and he wants to prove to everybody that he's not just hanging around for the sake, that he's still got a lot of game left. And he played pretty darn well last year. So it'll be interesting to see, but I think we have to wait. Time will tell whether Marty Brodeur still has what it takes to be a National Hockey League goaltender. And I think he's excited about this year, believe it or not, with the Corey Schneider acquisition after the dust had settled, to give him a little bit of a push and see where he is at right now in his game.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. We're joined by Ken Danico. He covers the New Jersey Devils for MSG Network.
Ken, you know, the Devils have obviously been very active, and I guess July 5th, they made a significant signing, one of some, you know, amongst others, of Ryan Clough. You know, a guy who was in San Jose was always a pretty good playoff performer, really good up and down winger, can score some goals. And he had struggles last year in San Jose, got moved to the Devils' rival, the Rangers, and then, of course, signs with the Devils. Were you surprised at the term that Clough got as compared to, say, teammate Michael Ryder?
Well, I think once David Clarkson had made his decision to go to Toronto, the Devils felt they were going to go as far as they could as far as contract money, financial terms, and years. Mm-hmm. They decided to move forward. Look, is it too many years? Possibly, no question about it. I've been a big Ryan Clough fan. If he's healthy and gets back to the way he played in San Jose, you've got a pretty darn good power forward. And, you know, a guy that you mentioned has been big in the playoffs, and you want guys that are clutch players, and I think he can really fill the void that David Clarkson is leaving here. But again, it's always wait and see. I mean, you make acquisitions, you think your team has improved and gotten better with the additions of Cole and Michael Ryder. But other teams could say the same thing. It's always about, let's see what kind of years they have. When you become an unrestricted free agent, to me, everybody gets overpaid. Yeah. And that's the way it is. So Lou did not want to lose Ryan Clough. I think he probably only had a three-year deal on the table, but he felt he was going to be that important to the team. And, I mean, if you look at David Clarkson, I love the guy, great player, but that's an astronomical contract for a guy that's not a top-line winger. So if you want a guy, it's their right. These guys have that opportunity once maybe in a lifetime to cash in, and anytime you become unrestricted, you cash in, and it's no different with Ryan Clough and David Clarkson. But the Devils wanted him bad, and they wanted to make sure they got him.
Ken, you just mentioned David Clarkson. He obviously signed the big contract with the Toronto Maple Leafs. Do you think Michael Ryder is going to be able to replace the offense that is being lost by David Clarkson going to Toronto?
I think so. I mean, Michael Ryder, like David Clarkson, is a streaky scorer. We see a lot of goal scorers seem to be in that category. It's tough to stay consistent in an 82-game schedule, but he's a guy that doesn't need as many opportunities, and that's something the Devils were missing last year. They had tons of opportunities. They outplayed teams. They played so hard, and in some of the stretches they went in, you just couldn't believe they were losing. I mean, they went 0-6-4 when Kovalchuk went down, and I think if I'm pretty accurate here, they dominated and outplayed teams quite significantly 8 of those 10 games, but they just couldn't put the puck in the net, so they're hoping a healthy Ryan Clough and Michael Ryder are going to be able to chip in, and they had the chances were there. It wasn't like they weren't getting chances of playing defensive. They just couldn't put the puck in the net. A guy like Michael Ryder doesn't need 3-4 chances in the slot. He only needs 1 or 2, and he's able to bury the puck, and I think that's what they're looking for from him.
Ken, you played with Patrick Elias quite a bit when he came in with the Devils, and you won 2 Stanley Cups with him, and he signed the 3-year contract with the Devils. How underrated, and obviously the Patrick Elias re-signing kind of was overshadowed by other moves that were made by the Devils and other teams, but how underrated is he over his entire career?
Yeah, Patrick's just one of those guys, I guess, has flown under the radar, you could say, no question about it. I mean, and that's the style of the Devils is about team and not about one individual, maybe to a fault at times because he probably should be getting more notoriety, more publicity. But he's been a consummate pro here, a guy that's been a lifelong Devil, as we know. And Patty's still playing at such a high level. I mean, probably the most consistent player last year in all facets of the game. And he's a guy that certainly he takes pride in being a Devil. He wanted to stay here. And the Devils rewarded him. I mean, some people might even think 3 years was a little bit long, but he keeps himself in tremendous shape, and he certainly didn't want to lose the stature of a Patrick Elias, especially now when with Ilya Kovalchuk gone. He's going to be counted on heavily offensively and certainly in the leadership role. Patrick really has been just such a terrific New Jersey Devil, and his number, no question in my mind, will be going up in the rafters the second he retires, and possibly Hall of Fame. I mean, that's how good he has been. But you guys nailed it. He's been a guy that just kind of has quietly gone about his business and been a real good performer in the National Hockey League for a lot of years here.
Ken, you mentioned Hall of Fame, so that's a nice transition to our final two questions. You were drafted in 1982, the first round by the Devils. Brendan Shanahan was drafted 5 years later, second overall by the Devils, and you played 4 seasons with him. Can you talk about Brendan Shanahan, the player, the person, and his Hall of Fame induction?
Yeah, well, it was, I was very proud of both those guys. I consider them both real good friends and keep in touch with Shanahan and certainly Scott Tomar. And you know what I loved about Brendan Shanahan? I mean, you never can anticipate a guy becoming a 600-goal scorer and having the career he did. But what I loved about him when he came as an 18-year-old kid, he was second overall pick, yet he was on the fourth line a lot of the season, and we made a real good run into the playoffs. The first time we had made the playoffs, the year he was drafted in 1987, and then the 87-88 season, we had a real good run. Mm-hmm. And he was on the fourth line. I just loved his character. I mean, he didn't sulk, he didn't whine. You know, here I'm second overall pick. I'm an offensive player, yet they've got me in a little bit of a different role. And he was 18, taking on the likes of Willie Plett in the Boston series and Jay Millers He was a guy that wanted to do anything to help your team win, and that's what I loved about Shanny. He was a guy that answered the bell in all different phases of the game, and he had to do it physically early on in his career, and he did it throughout his career, and he could play the game any way he wanted it, and that's what made him a special player, and he developed himself into be one of the elite goal scorers, a guy that anytime he was around the net, terrific shot, he could bury the puck. Obviously, we lost him, and we ended up getting a pretty good hockey
Yeah, pretty good.
Scott Stevens, another Hall of Famer, but I think it worked out at the time for both organizations. But Brendan is a class guy. I got a lot of respect for him, and obviously he's got a real tough job now as disciplinarian in the National Hockey League. But that's what I remember most about Brendan is when he came in and doing the little things, especially when the game was more physical and fighting was part of the playoffs. He didn't care. He would do whatever it took to help the club win early on, and that just showed me the character he had.
And final question, Ken. Great job so far, by the way. Final question, Scott Niedermeyer. You aforementioned Scott Stevens and Scott Niedermeyer were the core of those Devils teams that won many cups, and with Marty Brodeur, of course. Scott Niedermeyer really won everything in his career that he competed, you know, for. Can you talk about his game, you know, what made him so special and what he was like off the ice, too?
Scott Niedermeyer was a guy when he came in as a kid, 19-year-old, 18-year-old, so I said, was mature beyond his years on and off the ice. You see so many young kids, myself included, you get caught up into the lifestyle, everything else, and the money and the fortune and fame and everything else, and he was a guy that was 18 years old, 19 years old, going on 35 already as far as his mentality on and off the ice. He just was a guy that had everything in perspective, very quiet guy, as humble as you're going to meet. And what made him so special, obviously, we were becoming a better team. We added Scott Stevens, and then when we had, you know, a rock back during defense and Stevens, and then when you had a Scott Niedermeyer, you know, that offensive defenseman that changed the whole tempo of a game. He controlled games. I mean, it wasn't always about statistics. Yes, he still had over 700 points. Probably could have had a lot more, but it was just the way he controlled the game. I never seen a guy get hit less in the National Hockey League than Scott Niedermeyer. Not that guys didn't want to hit him, you just couldn't catch him. He was so elusive. Best skater I've ever seen in the National Hockey League. And you knew the puck was getting out of your end, whether it was skated or passed, with the way he played and the capabilities he had. I played with him as a D partner for the better part of 5 years, and I always used to just say, if I get the puck to Scott Niedermeyer, I'm going to play a long time in this league. Unfortunately, it worked out because you just had to look for him. And you know, I protect his back every once in a while, and the team will be happy with me because he was that important of a player. But the skating ability, I mean, I just remember early on, you know, he was getting breakaway after breakaway. And how many defensemen get breakaways? Yeah. He's making great moves. His skating ability was fantastic. And I'll tell you, one other funny story I'll never forget. It was about 3 years in his career. He went in deep, and, you know, I think it was one of the Boston forwards had a breakaway from the basically from the defensive blue line in, and Scott Niedermeyer was probably 15 steps behind, and he came out of nowhere in a flash, and I think our whole our bench's jaws dropped looking at him going, man, oh, man, we didn't realize how good this kid is, because it was just like a lightning bolt. Caught him easily. So we're going, we're in good hands here with this guy. And Jacques Lemaire always said, he goes, he'd meet with the defenseman. He goes, and, you know, we know Jacques played a defensive style, not as much pinching back then, certainly. And he goes, none of you guys have the green light. You got to be 100% sure. He says, except that guy over there. Scott, anytime, anywhere you want to go, you go. Because you're the only one capable of it. So I think that sums it up and tells you how good Scott Niedermeyer was, what type of skater he was. But I just have the utmost respect for him. He's such a great person, a guy that he was 19, and I looked up to him like an adult because of the maturity level I talked about.
Ken Danicogo is the New Jersey Devils color analyst. Ken, thanks very much for joining us. Just a fabulous interview this morning here on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
My pleasure, guys. Have a great day there in Winnipeg.
You too, Ken. Thanks
very
much.
Thanks a lot,
Ken. Let's go to break. Right. You're listening to TSN 1290, TSN1290.ca.
Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Big thank you to Ken Danico for that outstanding interview. It will be available for download on iTunes, on TSN1290.ca, and on IllegalCurve.com. Probably not available till Monday.
Remus.
We've given Remus the weekend off. He's at Folk Fest, yep. So we assume as long as he comes out of the woods, he'll be able to post that interview on Monday.
Drew, I just want to say this really quickly because I know Richie wants to get into salary arbitration here.
Yeah.
But, you know, Kenny Danico was saying really nice things about Scott Niedermeyer and Shanahan and Stevens. He was a heck of a defenseman himself. Rock-solid defenseman. Three-time Stanley Cup winner. We were at the draft in New Jersey, and you look up, you see Danico's number retired. So he was a pretty good defenseman himself.
Oh, absolutely. Salary arbitration, it's, you know, let's talk about salary arbitration. We all know that the five Winnipeg Jets players have filed for salary arbitration. Bogosian,
Little,
Wheeler, Tangrady,
and Postma.
And Postma. All five of those guys filed for salary arbitration.
Just so before we get into the real explanation of how the process works, the players declaring for arbitration guarantees that they will either have a contract by early August or be unrestricted free agents.
Right.
So that is why. So people are like, why would the players do this? I don't understand. Well, if a player doesn't offer arbitration and say the team doesn't either, the team has all the leverage because they could say, well, you're not going anywhere.
That's right. So. It's exactly. It guarantees that they're going to get paid. It doesn't mean, certainly, for those who are asking, it doesn't mean that the Winnipeg Jets still aren't going to sign the guys that they want to a long-term deal. Negotiations can still continue between now and whenever the arbitration hearing date is. Like, you know, around this room, all three of us would be surprised if they end up going to arbitration with Wheeler and with Bogosian and with Little, less so with Postma and Tangrady, but we'd be surprised if it ends up in an arbitration hearing. That being said, we wanted to provide some insight to our audience as to how salary arbitration works and what goes on in a hearing. So, Richard Pollock, let's start. You've gone through the CBA.
Yep.
You've gone through the new CBA, and you've picked out some of the highlights from the section.
Section 12 of the new CBA. So players have the right to opt for arbitration, and as does the team. The team has the salary of the player has to be above $1.75 million, and that's scaled annually based upon the average league salary if they're going to opt for it. Now, in this case, all five players in the Jets situation opted for salary arbitration.
So let me just clarify that one more time for the audience. Hypothetically, if Zach Bogosian does not file for arbitration when he did, the team has the right to take him to arbitration. They can file for team-elected arbitration so long as the player made $1.75 million the previous year.
Yeah.
Keep going.
Now, a player can only be taken to arbitration by a team once in his career. Now, again, not relevant here because all the players opted for arbitration. And a team,
and none of them have ever been taken to arbitration by the Jets.
But it wouldn't matter. They always have the right to do it themselves.
Yeah,
right, okay.
So now the other thing is a club can only take two guys per year to arbitration. Again, not relevant in this situation because the players have taken the team to arbitration.
Right, but if these guys end up going to arbitration and get a one-year contract next year, the Jets would have the opportunity to take players to arbitration if they so decided.
Provided the player hasn't been taken to arbitration in the past.
That's right, because like you said, a player can only be taken to arbitration.
Now, Blake Wheeler's gone to arbitration before, but I don't remember if that was opted by him or Boston. I'd have to look into that.
That was before he was traded to Atlanta.
Yeah.
Right, so it wouldn't apply because, like you said, a player can be taken to arbitration multiple times by different organizations.
No, I don't know if that's the case, Drew. I didn't read it that way. I'd have to look more closely to it, but I'm pretty sure it's only once in his career by any team.
Oh, it's once in his career across the board. Okay, I apologize for that. So what happens in an arbitration hearing? Zach Bogosian files for arbitration, and they set a date eventually of August whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what happens when they get into the room?
Well, essentially, it's like a court case, really. And what you have is you have eight arbitrators, and now they're agreed upon by the NHL and the NHLPA who the arbitrators are. They have to be part of the National Academy of Arbitrators. And then you have the players and the PA and then the NHL and the team. So they work together, just so people know behind the scenes. Like, the PA is giving the agent and the player information to support their argument, because of course the PA wants to increase salaries.
Mm-hmm.
The NHL is working with the team, if providing them any information they need, for their argument. And those are the quote-unquote four parties that would attend an arbitration.
Sure, they're doing research before they're doing research and getting their ducks in a row before they go into the hearing.
Now, similar to a court case, what they do is both sides submit briefs, argument, a written argument, 48 hours before the arbitration begins. So they have to submit it via email to the arbitrator. Within 10 minutes, no joke, that's what the CBA says, within 10 minutes, they have to then exchange their own briefs with each other.
So your arbitration hearing starts at 9 a.m. on Monday.
Yep.
By 8:50 a.m. on Monday, each side has to provide the...
By 9 a.m. on Monday, you need to submit your brief to the arbitrator. By 9:10, you have to have exchanged your brief, which are password protected, between the sides.
Sure, right. Okay, right. That's right. So you have 10 minutes. You have a 10-minute window after submitting your brief that you can then send it over to the opposition, in this case, being the team or the player.
Right. And the briefs are 40 minutes. Sorry, 40 pages max. So that doesn't include attachments and exhibits and such, but 40 pages of content, 40 pages of full argument.
So you have to make your argument within 40 minutes. Within 40 pages.
That's a lot for the argument for the player.
I mean, it seems like that would be a pretty in-depth brief in 40 pages.
Especially because it doesn't include pages. Attachments and such.
So, for the player, it's, they're being represented by their agent. This is where an agent is really making their money.
Yeah.
If a player goes to arbitration, because you have to convince... In hockey, can the arbitrator pick either one or the other, or can they admit, or they can?
As far as I can tell, they just pick a number. Generally, it's in the middle, but
so the player comes in and says, "I'm worth $4 million."
Yeah.
The team comes in and says, "You're worth $2 million." The arbitrator can pick any number between $2 and $4 million.
I believe. Yeah. I don't know if there's any restriction on picking even below or above those numbers, but I don't think that ever happens.
Right. It would be very unlikely for a player to come in at $4 million and the arbitrator to say, no, you're worth $6 million.
Right.
Okay. I want to go to break. And when we come back, I want to talk about the kind of examples that can be used, the kind of stats and the kind of, what can buttress an argument when you go to arbitration. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're continuing our explanation of what goes on regarding salary arbitration. So, Richard, there's an election of term. Can you explain what election of term generally means?
Sure, Drew. Well, I mean, arbitration can hand down a 1 or 2 year deal.
Which I bet you a lot of people don't know that, because they're so used to there being a one-year arbitration decision.
Now, whichever party's on the receiving end of the declaration, meaning in this situation, the Jets have 5 players who've declared for arbitration. Player opted.
Mm-hmm.
That means the Jets have the option of declaring whether or not they want the contract to be 1 or 2 years.
So all those 5 players have elected to go to arbitration. The Winnipeg Jets can now submit whether or not they want the arbitrator to reward them with a 1 year deal or a 2 year deal.
And if you don't make any declaration, it's just automatically a 1 year deal.
Now, putting you on the spot, you say you think there have been some 2 year rewards?
Yeah, I believe there's been at least one 2 year reward about 2 years ago, and I don't remember who it was. But I think one thing to note, Drew, is there's a catch there. If you're going to be a UFA after the following year,
mm-hmm.
you can't get a 2 year reward.
So next year. After next year, when Zach Bogosian is scheduled to be a UFA.
No, he's 2 years. Wheeler would be 1 year, I believe.
Sure. So, pardon me, yeah.
The Jets couldn't say, I want a 2 year deal for Wheeler.
Because they'd be taking away one of his UFA years. Right. So there is a bit of an asterisk next to that.
And Richie, there's a high probability that most of these guys don't go to arbitration, correct?
I'd say there's like a 95% chance.
Right. So, I mean, we for people listening out there, I mean, that are saying, oh, well, what if Bogosian or Wheeler goes to arbitration, that means that they can only be signed to a 1 year or 2 year deal, well, basically assigned by the arbitrator.
Mm-hmm.
But you'd have to think that it would be less difficult to digest if it was Tangrady or Postma, but we should mention that it's highly unlikely this is
I think we can
a formality in it. This doesn't mean that Bogosian, Little, or Wheeler, or Postma, for that matter, are necessarily only going to be signed for 1 or 2 years. That's if it actually gets to that process.
I think we can all agree in this room that if Bogosian, Wheeler, or Little end up in salary arbitration, something has gone wrong in the negotiation.
Right.
I would agree.
And there's
that.
No indication that that is the case.
Well, we don't know.
We're in the process right now.
Yeah. They're in the process. Exactly right. This was just strictly a housekeeping move that the players made, that the players took care of in order to continue negotiations, but to guarantee that they have a contract for next year.
That's right. And before we get into the evidence, I just want people to know, because we're trying to explain how arbitration works. Each side gets 90 minutes to argue, total of 90 minutes.
So the meeting is set for 9 a.m. Each side has 90 minutes to make their case.
And the player, if the player opted for arbitration, it's considered, you know, their motion. So they would go first.
Mm-hmm.
The team would reply, the player, and then the team. And then there's a little bit of time, 10 minutes for sub rebuttal. So if a player... The first party gets that. So if the second party brings up a lot of new information, then they're allowed to reply for 10 minutes. But it's a 90 minutes.
So it is a back and forth.
It's a back and forth. Exactly, Drew. But you have to allot your time accordingly. You can't just, you know, use 90 minutes the first argument. You can't reply after if there's something that's not new.
Right.
So it's not very long, Drew, in reality. I mean, you know, 90 minutes for the entirety of the argument to determine the salary. It's not short necessarily, but it's not the longest. And we should note that if it is, not that that's probably going to come up, but if it is the arbitrator's first ever NHL hearing, then they give the sides both 15 minutes extra.
Sure. So the arbitrator gets a little bit of a wiggle room to handle his rookie jitters, right?
Yeah.
Now, in terms of evidence, statistics, affidavits, witnesses, that can all be included if it's in the brief.
Yeah, so no rules of actual evidence apply. So no American, like, legal rules apply to the evidence. The arbitrator has the kind of discretion to have in what he wants, provided it's within the context of the CBA rules.
For the most part, in these arbitration hearings, the agent and the player aren't bringing in witnesses, though, are they?
I mean, you can. I don't think that's common. I think the statistical evidence is the biggest thing, and what they say is it has to be in the brief. You have to exchange it beforehand. You can't just, one thing to know, you can't just bring up a random player in the middle of the argument. You have to prepare everything and give the both sides, like you do in
a court of law.
Exactly.
So there are 7 different categories of evidence that can be brought into the arbitration.
Yeah, it's kind of limited.
Sure. Category A is the overall performance, including statistics, offensive and defensive, of the player in the previous season or seasons. So can they go back as far as they want? Sounds like they can. And they can, or they can just look in a, and they can look in a wide vacuum or a narrow vacuum of past performance. Category B, the number of games played by the player, his injuries or illnesses during the preceding seasons. Were you healthy 2 years ago, but you were injured last year?
Yeah.
It's all legal. That's right. It's all, can be brought forward. Category C, the length of service of the player in the league and or with the club. You know, how long has he been a member in good standing of the Winnipeg Jets?
And also,
yes,
you know, how many years did he play in the NHL?
Sure.
You know, in terms of his contractual status.
Right. Category D, the overall contribution of the player to the competitive success or failure of his club in the preceding season. So that seems a lot more subjective.
Well, I imagine, Richie, though, if you're the agent for Bogosian or Wheeler, a team that hasn't made the playoffs, I bet are you not presenting stats of when Bogosian's in the lineup, what the record is, stuff like that, right?
Yeah, because they don't, very possibly,
right?
And, you know, he's, and for Bogosian, for example, you would say the overall contribution. He fights for his teammates, he'll drop the gloves, he'll play hurt, you know, all that stuff.
Category E, any special qualities of leadership or public appeal not inconsistent with the fulfillment of his responsibilities as a playing member of his team.
Is that talking about community service?
That's like the whole Ty Domi thing. You know, Ty Domi means this much to the Leafs because he's a huge part of the team and the organization, and he's great with the fans and all that kind of
stuff. Well, for Zach Bogosian, he was a member of Illegal Curve's Movember team.
Sure, I think that's high up on his arbitration hearing.
But, you'd throw that in. I mean, Bogo was a proud member of Team Illegal Curve, so
I don't know about how proud he was. Category F, the overall performance in the previous season or seasons of any player or players who is alleged to be comparable to the party player whose salary is in dispute. That's pretty much, who are your comparisons in the NHL? Right. What are they getting paid?
That's right.
And the final category, category G, the compensation of any player or players who is alleged to be comparable to the party player, provided, however, that in applying this or any of the above subparagraphs, the salary arbitrator shall not consider a player or players to be comparable to the party player.
Okay, so all that means...
Okay, stop.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. Drew, I lost you after subparagraph.
You have to bring up the comparable player beforehand. That's what it means.
So
you
it has to be included in your
exactly.
brief.
Exactly. Richie has a law degree, so he's used to talking in, you know...
Gibberish?
Yeah.
So if the player is...
You can't bring up a player out of nowhere and say this is... You have to give all the information beforehand. That's
if
what
Zach Bogosian wants to compare himself to Drew Doughty, he has to put it in his
that's
written
right.
brief.
Yeah.
And if TSN 1290 was doing an arbitration hearing, I would compare myself to Drew Mandel.
Yeah.
And obviously say I'm more valuable to the station.
Okay, information that's inadmissible, Drew?
Any information that's inadmissible, and we'll go as quickly as possible. Okay. Any standard player contract which began when the player was not a Group 2 player.
Right.
So it can't include his entry-level deal.
That's right.
Any standard player contract entered into by an unrestricted free agent.
Right.
So you can't compare a restricted free agent.
You can't compare apples to oranges. You can't compare UFAs and entry-level deals to RFA deals.
Okay. The standard player contract of any player who is not being offered as a comparable player to the party player.
Exactly. You can't just pick numbers. That you have to present your argument of which guys are the comparables.
Category D, qualifying offers made by the club pursuant to Section 10.2B.
So that's like the minimum threshold. So when you're doing your argument, you're not talking about, well, this is, I assume that's what they're talking about in terms of minimum threshold, but I would have to look further into that.
Category E, any prior offers or history of negotiations between the player and the club.
It's like anything. When you're negotiating, you can't bring in numbers. It's all off the record.
It's right. It's a fresh negotiation as if nothing happened before. Category F, testimonials, videotapes, newspaper columns, press game reports, or similar materials.
Yep.
I.e., what we say and what we write doesn't matter.
That's right.
Category G, any reference to actual or potential walkaway rights.
You can't say, well, if we do this, then we can walk away. You can't refer to that.
Right. And a team has the option to walk away if a player is awarded more than $3.5 million.
That's right. So that's an issue if it's Tingrati and Postma.
Sure.
The Jets can't walk away.
Right.
They're not going to make more than that.
That's right. If the arbitrator ever signs for that, there's a problem. The arbitrator might need to be investigated if his last name might be Tingrati or Postma.
Yeah, right.
Category H, any award issued by a salary arbitrator as to which a club exercised its walkaway rights pursuant to Section 12.10.
Which I'm assuming is the basis of it's not actually a contract because it wasn't actually agreed to, so it can't be used as admissible.
Right. Yeah. The financial condition of the club or the league. So if the team, if you're the New Jersey Devils and you're about to go bankrupt,
you can't use that.
It
That's right.
doesn't apply. Category J, references to a club's upper or lower limit or to the player's share.
So if it puts a team over a cap, it's irrelevant. You have to deal with that after the fact. It's not relevant in terms of if you're the Flyers going to arbitration, you're already over the cap. It doesn't matter.
And the final category, any salary arbitration award issued in 2005 or 2006.
Right.
Which is sort of a random year.
I
think it's because it's dated. The salaries have changed so much that they want it to be within a reasonable gap of time.
So next year that would change to what, 2006?
Yeah, anything prior to 2005.
So prior to 2000. I thought,
right.
Okay.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
So there you have it. That's sort of the rundown of what happens in salary arbitration and how it actually works when the two sides eventually get into the room together. Like we said, we wouldn't expect it still for Bogosian, Little, or Wheeler. Post-Martin-Grady, I think it's more of a possibility, but both sides will probably do what they can to avoid it.
Now, I have a question for you, Richie. You know, as we go to break, can I exercise my walk-away rights right now?
Didn't you use that on a girl once?
I don't know, but I should definitely walk or exercise or whatever.
I assure you the girl walked away long before Ezzy was exercising his walk-away rights. Anyways, let's go to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. One final segment on this Saturday here with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, facebook.com/IllegalCurve, and our website is www.illegalcurve.com. We thought we'd spend the last segment doing much like the rest of the hockey world did earlier this week and paying tribute to Don Baisley.
Yep.
Richie, you had the opportunity to meet with Don Baisley on a couple of different occasions, so why don't you sort of just talk about the impact that he had on the hockey world and the kind of classy gentleman that he was.
Well, you know, Drew, you haven't heard anybody say anything bad about the guy, and I think that's for a good reason. I think he was a class act. I think he, you know, was, I think, the, in many ways, the face of hockey in Winnipeg, especially NHL hockey. After NHL hockey left the city, he didn't leave the city. He talked about how important it was for him to stay in the city. And I think his relationship with the players that he had and his manner of going about what he did, you know, the agent business is can be a dirty business. And he was able to do it with class and integrity and had the respect of his peers, respect of general managers, respect of the league, and respect of his players. And I think his players, his relationship with his players, I thought was just spoke volumes. The amount of the distance they traveled to come to the memorial, the fact that they all kept in touch with him while he was battling his illness. I think that if you look at the players that he had throughout his career as clients, for the most part, I think they kind of are a great, you know, metaphor for who he was as a person. Solani, Kariya, Forsberg, Sack, class acts, Hedberg, Nielsen, class acts.
Theo Fleury.
Yeah, on and off the ice. And there's things that, you know, he wanted them to act a certain way. He did, you know, he negotiated for them. I think they were at one point, the first four I mentioned, were making close to $10 million all a year at the same time. But he negotiated all those contracts in such a respectful manner. And I think a really interesting quote I read, I think it was an Eric DeHatrick's article.
I just tweeted out that article. Yeah. It's a fabulous article.
Might have been in the Free Press as well. The idea that, I think it was in DeHatrick's article, though, the idea that it's that he thought his clients were better off signing for less than for more, because he said that in that situation, the GM who signed into the contract would be more apt to protect the player from the criticisms of the public, as opposed to the opposite when if the GM were to overpay the player, then he would be blaming him.
Here's the quote, and it came from Justice Alan McInnes of Manitoba Court of Appeal, lifelong friend of Don Baisley. It made me appreciate why there wasn't a general manager in hockey who didn't like or respect Don, said Justice McInnes. There were two things Don believed in. The first was that you were better to be slightly underpaid than to be slightly overpaid. Than to be overpaid, because if the general manager believed he got a good deal, he would be protective of you if things weren't going well. If you were overpaid, the general manager wouldn't have to wear that, so he'd be mad at you. The other was Don's clients honored their contracts. His view was, do your deal, and you don't worry if, in 2 weeks' time, someone you don't think is as good as you signed for more money. I think that's another reason GMs loved him. They knew once they had a deal, they had a deal. You know, and it's true in that in this day and age of, you know, you hear a guy who's got puts his name on paper, and it's a signed contract, and it's legally binding, and it's not worth anything a week or 2 weeks later, and you know, Don Baisley certainly didn't operate that way.
There's many great quotes that kind of speak to the kind of person he was. And I think the reception in the hockey world, and the hockey world's a tight-knit community.
Yep.
But, I mean, they don't make a fuss about everybody. And I think the attention this has gotten, I think, is well-deserved. And a lot the thing is that he always kind of flew below the radar. You know, he didn't need the spotlight. You know, the whole thing about how he never gave anybody a scoop. He kept things private. He was a family person. I think the players speak about him as a father or a friend and not an agent. And isn't that most important? They don't just get the money and get out.
Yeah, and Richie, you know, I know you've met Don Baisley before, and I've never had the chance to meet him. But I've always heard a lot of about him, and I knew a lot of people that knew him, you know, specifically Winnipeg lawyers. But I'm learning so much more about him, and what people are saying him after he unfortunately passed is just unbelievable. And, you know, his legacy of that he's left behind for Winnipeg and hockey, I mean, they essentially dedicated the draft to him in New Jersey. He passed away shortly before the draft, and it's unbelievable. The legacy he leaves behind is incredible.
One more quote.
Okay.
This is about This is Anders Hedberg telling him what, telling the reporters what Don Baisley told him. You love people and you use things, but don't ever get that backwards.
Again, another great quote. And so we'd like to share with everyone else and sharing our condolences and paying tribute to Don Baisley. Let's end the show with cheers and jeers.
Cheers. Congratulations.
He's brilliant.
He's a good guy.
And jeers.
No, not good enough.
He's a bad boy.
I never seen something
surprisingly not good.
Richard Paul, quickly, please.
You just spoke about the unfortunate passing of Don Baisley. My cheer this week goes to the induction to the Hockey Hall of Fame of the late Fred Shiro,
mm-hmm.
father of Ray Shiro.
From Winnipeg.
The father, the head and the coach of the 70s Flyers, which were obviously a polarizing team, but an innovator. Somebody who, to me, is long overdue to get into the Hall of Fame. I think it's a great day for their family. And I think it's well-deserved.
Yeah. Pat Burns will get in eventually.
Has he?
I'm going to cheer Lou Lamoriello. And this is why I'm going to cheer Lou Lamoriello.
Okay.
Because he's a class act, one of the most well-respected guys in the NHL. But he could have gone off on Ilya Kovalchuk. And instead, he just, you know, gave his answers and said, you know, it didn't work out. Ilya wants to be in Russia. He was very diplomatic. And I give him my cheer for that.
I'll wrap up cheers and jeers. I'm going to cheer the San Jose Sharks Twitter feed. When the Sharknado movie was taking the world by storm earlier this week, the ESPN Twitter feed tweeted at the San Jose Sharks saying, "Hey, at San Jose Sharks, thoughts on changing your name to the San Jose Sharknados?" The San Jose Sharks Twitter feed responded and said, "Hey, at ESPN, thoughts on showing more hockey highlights."
Great.
So a great response by the San Jose Sharks to the ESPN Twitter feed. That's it for this Saturday morning and the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. A big thank you to our guests, Ken Danico and Mike Greenlay. A big thank you to our sponsors, Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club and the Certified General Accountants Association of Manitoba. In case you missed any of the show, it will be available for download on TSN1290.ca, on IllegalCurve.com, and on iTunes. You can follow us on Twitter at IllegalCurve, Facebook.com/IllegalCurve, and the website with the latest NHL and Winnipeg Jets news is IllegalCurve.com. For producer Tim, who gets us on and off the air like the expert that he is, for my colleagues Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg, I'm your host, Drew Mandel. If it's Saturday, it's the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.